For more information on Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please visit our website.
Good evening, everyone. For newcomers, I'm Taigen Layton, the guiding Dharma teacher at Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, and I'm very happy to have with us tonight Stephen Hein, who has spoken at our Zendo on Irving Park Road many times and is now joining us on our virtual Zoom Zendo. So to introduce Stephen, he's maybe the most eminent American Zen scholar, certainly the most eminent scholar of Dogen, the 13th century founder of Soto Zen that we practice in our tradition. And if I read the names of all of the books that he's published, there'd be no time left for him to speak tonight. So I'll just mention a few of them. Dogen and the Koan Tradition, A Tale of Two Shobogenzo Texts. This is a very important book about Dogen's approach to koans, which is different from what most American Zen people think of as koan practice. Another one is Did Dogen Go to China, which is a wonderful survey of Dogen's career. Shifting Shape, Shaping Texts is a book about the fox koan that I've spoken about a few times recently. There's Opening a Mountain, which is another book on koans. There's a recent book on Shobogenzo and his comments on it. Flowers Blooming on a Withered Tree is forthcoming, I believe soon, and a very important book for those of you who are into Soto Zen, because it's about the early centuries of Soto Zen after Dogen. Stephen has also published half a dozen or so edited volumes of anthologies of about Zen. I've contributed to a number of chapters to a number of them, including Zen Rituals and Zen Classics. And Stephen is not just buried in medieval Japan and China. He's also published books on Zen in the contemporary context, including one on a modern master called Bargaining for Salvation, Bob Dylan, a Zen master. So there's many more. I couldn't name them all. So Stephen, welcome. Thank you for coming. And please take it away.
And I always say that Taigen forgot more than I'll ever know about Dogen. And his accomplishments are well known and very profound. I'm very happy to be here on Zoom. I guess we've all gotten used to the virtual meetings over these last few months. And I was supposed to be in Chicago in early May and give a talk at the University of Chicago and also at Ancient Dragon. And that was one of several things that kind of triggered off my thinking in terms of the topic for tonight, relating to Dogen and some other examples I'll be reading from Zen and Buddhist and other religious writings in a few minutes, in terms of the question of what I've used as the title, travel and place, which means do you have to go forth to travel in order to realize the genuine place of awakening? And if you do have to go out forth to travel, we're all in trouble right now, I guess, because it's limited. But Dogen comments on that and anticipates some of those issues, I think, in his writings, especially in Shobogenzo. And I'll be talking about a particular chapter and a particular concept called Henzan, which I translate as extensive travels or transient travels for studying, and I'll come back to that in a few moments. Let me start by first pointing out, if you can see behind me, the scroll of that's a Zen scroll I bought in China some years ago that has the large character for Zen at the top, and then a famous Han Dynasty poem, and then a drawing. You might be able to see a drawing of a Zen master with carrying rosary beads and his traveling staff. I also wanted to point out a recent book that I published that Taigen mentioned, called Readings of Dogen's Treasury of the True Dharma Eye, and that's the translation for Shobo Genzo. And on the cover, very happy with the way the cover turned out. If you can see, there's on the side here the picture of an old manuscript that I was able to acquire from 1803. And Dogen, of course, died in 1253, but it took 750 years before the Shobo Genzo was first published. And in 1803, in connection with his death anniversary of 750 years, the Shobo Genzo was first produced as a woodblock print. At that time, it was pretty much only available to Soto priests in Japan and other interested parties, and then it took another 100 years for it to be published in a modern typeset publication and get widely distributed. One thing is, when they published this version in 1803, it consisted of 20 booklets, each containing several chapters. And those booklets were actually spread out. That took 15 years for them to get all those booklets available. So some of them are still around. I was able to pick up a couple of them at auctions in Japan. And inside the book, there is a calligraphy of the four characters of Shobo Genzo by Kaz Ta-Nehisi, an eminent Dutch translator of Shobo Genzo and many other writings by Dogen and other Zen masters. So let me say a few more words about the Shobo Genzo project, and then come into my main topic on Henzan extensive travels. So Shobo Genzo is something I've been thinking about for 45 years. I started in this business in 1975 when I was first in graduate school, and a famous book on Dogen was published by an author named Heejin Kim that influenced a lot of us and still is a great book to read. And Shobo Genzo is not the kind of book that's easy to read or easy to feel like confident that you've understood it. It's very difficult and challenging in many ways, and that makes it thought-provoking and inspirational, but it's also paradoxical and perplexing and puzzling. And he makes puns in Chinese, using Chinese characters with Japanese pronunciations, and he creates many rhetorical flourishes that are designed to make you think and rethink and think about it again. And there's numerous translations of Shobo Genzo available now. And for any given sentence, you could look at five or six translations. And if you read the Japanese, you try to translate it yourself, and you're still not quite sure if you captured the meaning, because there's double negations and triple negations and irony, and it depends on the flow of the sentence within that paragraph or within that whole chapter. And many times you have to really reconsider it. And sometimes I recommend, and I think Taigen more or less agrees with this point, that sometimes it's good to skim through it and try to absorb it by osmosis rather than struggling with reading it sentence by sentence in order to get a flavor of what Dogen's talking about in general, what phrases he likes to emphasize, what points he tries to come back to and reemphasize. And then after absorbing a lot of it on a certain superficial level that seeps in, then you can kind of come back and take a closer look at passages one by one and still maybe end up mystified, but that's part of the fun of it. So what did I learn in writing this the book this time? And I think one thing is that there's a lot of ways to kind of sum up Dogen very briefly. He sums it up himself with catchphrases like casting off body mind. I came back to my home country from visiting Japan empty-handed. And life is a dream within a dream. And life is a continuous mistake. And he uses certain catchphrases over and over again. Realization is here and now. That give us a clue. I think one of the phrases that he occasionally uses and sums up some of the ideas is Buddhas becoming Buddhas. So awakening is not a matter of beings transforming into Buddhas or Buddhas or Bodhisattvas coming down to earth, so to speak, in order to help transform the beings. But the beings are already Buddhas without realizing they are Buddhas. But if you look at that as an object, if you look at the Buddha within you as something static, that's going to detract and distract you from realizing that you are the Buddha. So he talks about the Buddhas becoming Buddhas, but that many people are too deluded to realize they are Buddhas. And in their delusion, they may get far away from being a Buddha and live in a dark cave somewhere on the far side of the mountain. But even there, the one bright pearl is lustrously shining, and the light within, or the taking a step back to let the light shine within, is still available. And I think this is a key point if we tie this into the topic of henzan or transient travels. So the word henzan, which Kaz Ta-Nehisi translates as all-inclusive study, and study is an important part of it, is made up of two Chinese characters, and san or zan is study, but it also means movement towards the place where you're going to study. So the street leading to a big temple or shrine, for example, is referred to as a san because it's the route that takes you towards the place where something sacred is going to happen. And so it's the journey that is the reward, so to speak, as Steve Jobs once said. But san also means the study itself. And the study itself could be a kind of academic study, reading, taking notes, having discussions, writing comments, or it could be intense master-disciple relationship and study on a more intimate and spiritual level. The hen in the word henzan refers to going widely, going broadly. So one of the ideas that distinguished Zen in China, Japan, and Korea, and is still practiced to some extent, especially in Korea, is the idea that at certain times of the year, the younger monks especially, known as clouds and water, onsui in Japanese, were encouraged or more or less required to travel to various temples and test out where they would fit in and ask the master questions, challenge the master, see if that was the right person. The master, of course, is testing the potential disciple. And this was expected and required for monks to do until they were ready to determine that this is the temple that they would study at. And that henzan stage could last for several years or even many years before the settling down. Once you settled down, that was known as hanging up your traveling staff because you no longer needed to continue the pathway. And so that's built into Zen, that travel or movement is going to take place, and you can't stand still. You can't just stay in one place. That seems to be the implication. Now, of course, once the virus hit us all in March, for me, many travel plans to Japan and Chicago and China were called off, and I'm sure everybody had their own challenges they went through. And, you know, the words that came up over and over again were stay in place, stay safe, stay observant. And, you know, the place became very important because your place was also all of a sudden very limited, and you were cut off from the usual navigation and negotiations that we all go through. You know, Dogen says in a passage, and this is in another writing that Taigen translated, the extensive record of Dogen, in number 154, he says, don't walk away from where you are. And Among challenges him and says, well, isn't that rigid and inflexible? And he said, no, you don't understand what flexibility is, if you ask me that question. And so that gives a kind of counterpoint. And there are other passages where Dogen refers to awakening with the Japanese word tokoro, which means the place, a place. You know, right here is the place. And so how do we understand those two tendencies? Now, to look a little bit more at the travel impulse in Zen and other examples, there's an ancient Chinese saying, it's better to walk 10,000 miles than to read 10,000 books. And St. Augustine said that the world is a book, and those who do not travel read only one page. And of course, in many traditions from biblical and other mythological traditions and Buddhist traditions, like traveling on the Silk Road by Xuanzang, movement is seems to be imperative. And Dogen himself, of course, traveled, and he traveled to China. And he would not have become Dogen and gotten awakened and had the teaching if he hadn't gone to China. And he says about his travel to China that we board a boat and sail out into the middle of the ocean where the mountains are no longer in sight. That is, that they are beyond the horizon. And, you know, I always come back to that saying because Dogen, like most Japanese, were pretty much landlocked. They did travel in small boats on the inner waterways of Japan. That's how they navigated around quite a bit. But they didn't go out to sea very much. And Dogen was one of the first travelers to China after several hundred years where travel had been cut off. And the shift in perspective that's physical and mental and spiritual when you are cut off from seeing the high mountains in your line of vision, you know, is quite a profound experience and was probably necessary stage for Dogen to come to his own realization. Now, let me refer briefly to a famous poet from this period, actually about 100 years before Dogen, named Su Shi, also known as Su Dongpo. And Dogen cites Su Shi's poetry. Su Shi was one of the famous poets in China. He wasn't a Zen monk, but he did study with Zen monks. And Dogen cites one of his poems in the fascicle chapter of Shobogenzo called Keisei San Shoku. And this is a different poem. And in this poem, he talks about floating in the water. He's on a lake. One thing about Su Shi was that he was a famous poet in the capital city, but he ran into some political problems, and he was banished from the capital. And that happened in stages. They would send him away and then send him away again, and this was the beginning of that stage. So we have to think that in his mind, some anxiety about the travel is going on. But anyway, he says that he's traveling in a lake, very peaceful, and he's asleep in the boat, in a cabin in the boat, and then he hears a sound and he thinks it's pouring rain, so he gets up to see, and it's not the rain, it's just the wind rustling the reeds nearby the boat. And he looks out and he sees this perfectly calm, everything's asleep. You know, one fish gets startled by his presence and runs off like a fox, he says, but everything else is very calm and peaceful and serene and quiet, and he's very mellowed out. And then all of a sudden, he says, I am filled with a sense of unease and trepidation because I realize this beautiful scene vividly passing right before my eyes will vanish in the blink of an eye. And sure enough, the rooster starts to crow, and bells are sounding on the land, and the drum is beating on the boat, and the birds are singing as they flutter away. And he doesn't comment anymore, but there's a sense that the staying in place, you know, is always going to be disrupted. Even if you're in that place, the disruption is going to happen because of the activity in the surroundings and the environment that you're within. So staying in place is not necessarily static either. It's a question of the cycles of nature and the day and night around you, but it's also a question of your perception and how you take those in. Now, let me read another poem by a Chinese Zen poet from this era that's called Taking the Step Back. And there's 12 verses on, he says, not where each one starts. Nothing is better than taking a step back. So I'll read two verses. Nothing is better than taking a step back. Be sure to cultivate yourself thoroughly from head to toe, because when you blow out a flame that's burning in your heart, you probably miss seeing the anger that's emanating from your belly. Second, nothing is better than someone who takes a step back, like a lone cloud or wild crane moving freely, whether or not coming from or going to a sanctuary down the road, I smile up at the bright moon hovering over the peak. So the moon is there, and it may be hidden, or it may be very visible, maybe full or new moon, but it's there, whatever place that you are in. And so that's part of the message. Now, Dongshan, the Chinese Zen master that started the Soto sect, he says, I travel alone, and everywhere I can meet it, meaning the Dharma. It is now truly me, but I am not it. So Dongshan talks about traveling, moving, but wherever he is the Dharma. But he's not, you know, the Dharma is not exactly him either, because you have to realize that Dharma is something that needs to be awakened to or attained. So that's an interesting perspective on it. Now, let me mention another couple of passages by Dogen. Back to extensive record, number 95. He says, for 20 years, I have been studying the ancestral schools, widely visiting teachers amid the autumn chrysanthemums and green pines. So the seasons are changing for 20 years. He went to China in 1223. This saying was written in 1243. So he acknowledges that he's traveled, and not only did he go to China, but in Japan, he went from the capital city of Kyoto to the island of Kyushu to take the boat to China, and then he moved from Kyoto up into the mountains. So he's acknowledging the importance of movement. But in another passage from the book Shobogenzo Sui Monkey, sometimes translated as Record of Things Heard, he says, it is not possible to obtain wide knowledge just by traveling extensively. Make up your mind to give up trying to do this and instead focus your attention entirely on one practice. Study the ideas you need to know from traditional ways they are exemplified in the techniques of your predecessors. So it's not surprising to find kind of complementary or contradictory sayings in Dogen and in Zen, because paradoxes is frequently taking place. But what is the importance for Dogen? Now, let's come back to my own experience a little bit. One thing that I do for exercise every day of the year, regardless of the virus, or I was doing it long before the virus, is to go walking in the early morning and evening, you know, just to get a walk in for exercise. And I live in a pretty quiet area, but there's a fairly big road nearby that I kind of don't have to see or be bothered with, but you can hear it. Now, I'm sure everybody's had an experience like this, is that I started to notice by the second week, when things were locked down back in late March and April, all of a sudden I started hearing birds. I mean, I actually started to think birds weren't migrating to Florida anymore, because I wasn't hearing them. I started to realize I had missed them. I missed hearing them, and it was just overwhelmed by the traffic. And, as time, things have gone back and there's more traffic now than there was back in April, it starts to get drowned out again. But that deep bird sound, but I mean deep sound, it's like you don't just hear a few birds here and there. I mean, you hear birds at very different levels. So some are nearby, some are far away. Some seem to be calling to each other. Some, uttering different kinds of songs and sounds. It was a very enriching experience for me. I had to really appreciate this was one of the silver linings of the virus situation. And I think that's part of what Dogen is getting to. So let's go back to Henzan. Henzan is a chapter in Shobogenzo. And there's a lot of other ones that are more famous, but this is one of the interesting ones on the concept of extensive travel. And he cites a koan in which the master, Shui Feng, said to his disciple, Xuan Sha. Now that's the same Xuan Sha that's known for the saying of one bright pearl that Dogen has another chapter about. But in this one, he is a disciple, and the master says to him, why are you still here? Why haven't you gone out for your extensive travels? And Xuan Sha says, Bodhidharma never came to China from India, and the second patriarch never went to India to look for Bodhidharma when he returned. And Dogen said, this is fantastic. He did a somersault. Now, the phrase a somersault is used by Dogen and a lot of Zen teachers to refer to turning things upside down and topsy-turvy. So as soon as you assume one interpretation, you have to be told the opposite. And this is the somersault because Xuan Sha is saying, no, it's unnecessary to travel. And a verse that comments on this by a monk named Giyuan says, clouds waft above mountains and waters return to the sea. Birds do not fly away from the sky and fish keep swimming in the water. So if we go back to the Su Shi poem where he wakes up in the boat in the middle of the night, you're seeing the birds flying and the fish swimming, and it kind of disrupts the calmness when it seems like almost nothing is happening in the dead of night. But at the same time, what is happening doesn't take the birds and the fish outside of their element. So in a sense, they are staying in their place, even if they are moving quite a distance. And of course, Dogen has a famous paragraph on that in the Genjo Koan chapter, where he talks about the fish, stay in the water and the birds stay in the air, and draw some parallels and differences to human existence. Okay, so what is Dogen's intention here with these various passages? Again, to sum up, Dogen was certainly part of the tendency in Zen and most other religious traditions to make a pilgrimage, make a journey, learn in the process of the movement, find a sacred place, find a special teacher, find a true teaching. And he was certainly one of the great exemplars of that, because his travel to China, again, comes after many centuries when travel was cut off. Of course, I always remind my students that even though China and Japan seem very close to one another, it's a very treacherous waterway because of typhoons and piracy. And the Japanese were not great boat makers at that time, and we see that from the Mongol invasion, how they were almost overwhelmed. So they didn't, they were very reluctant to travel. And when they got to China, they didn't travel very far inland for the most part either. Fortunately, when Dogen went to China, the major Zen temples were located along the coastline city near the city of Hangzhou, which Marco Polo visited some years in the same century as Dogen, and so they didn't have to travel as far as other kinds of pilgrims in world history, but travel was essential. But when Dogen starts his temples, I mean, partly he has an impetus to tell people not to travel because he wants them to stay with him. And I'm not saying that in a skeptical or scornful way. He's trying to build his sangha. He's trying to develop his assembly. And he certainly feels confident that what he's teaching is very different from the conventional teaching of Buddhism at the time. And the, you know, he wants to encourage people there. But at the same time, to build his, when he moves from Kyoto to the mountains, to build his community in the mountains, he had to get people to come from all over the place. And he says, like, you know, they're flocking to him from northern parts of Japan and the northern provinces. And of course, some came up and followed him from Kyoto. Movement was essential. But once they got there, he hoped that they would stay with him. And they did. But in the generations after Dogen, his movement, the Soto school, began to spread very far and wide also. And so the travels or the movement comes up once again. Now back to the Henzan chapter. This is one of the of several chapters where Dogen quotes his teacher, his Chinese teacher, Ru Jing, under whom he studied when he got to China. And after being disappointed by the first teachers he met in China for the first couple of years and very disillusioned and ready to go back to Japan, unfulfilled, he, by various auspicious circumstances, was led to meet with Ru Jing, and he stayed put for 2 years and studied with him, cast off body mind, had many private conversations with Ru Jing, was given a kind of inner or intimate teaching that other disciples didn't hear, and then was able to transport and transmit that back to Japan. And in the Henzan chapter, he quotes Ru Jing, who he refers to as my late master, the old Buddha, or the ancient Buddha. One time he was asked to give a talk to members of his assembly who had gathered from various places, apparently to come and hear his teaching, because he was known as an excellent lecturer. And he ascended the teaching seat and said, "The great road has no gate. It leaps out from the heads of all of you. The open sky has no road. It enters into my nostrils. In this way, when we meet," and then he kind of makes one of his Zen-style humorous comments, "when we meet as Gotama's bandits or Linji's troublemakers, we realize, ha, the great house tumbles down and the spring wind swirls about us. Astonished, the apricot blossoms fly and scatter red color everywhere." So I think, you know, as Dogen often does, he interprets that and kind of picks apart some of the key phrases in the poem. And you know, one thing we know about Dogen is that, not so much in this example, but there are many examples where he will take Ru Jing to task, as much as he admires and respects Ru Jing. And he said, you know, Ru Jing never deceived me, I deceived Ru Jing. And he defers to Ru Jing. He also, as a Zen master in his own right, takes license to sometimes modify or correct, so to speak, some sayings by Ru Jing. But here, I think he's very appreciative of what Ru Jing is saying. "The great road has no gates. The great house tumbles down and spring wind swirls. And the red color of the apricot blossoms fly and scatter around." Now, part of the symbolism of the red apricot blossoms flying and scattering around has to do with the dragon gates. You know, so there are several legends about the dragon gates in in Chinese mythology that got taken over by Zen symbolism. And one of the ideas is that there was a special waterfalls in northwestern China where the some of the fish would swim upwards on the water and try to get to the top. And of course, almost impossible to do. But then a great storm would build up and thunderous rain would fall down. And somehow one or two of the special fish made it. And to celebrate that that triumph, the rain would clear off, the sun would shine, and then blossoms would scatter everywhere to commemorate the special circumstances. And that symbolism got taken over by Zen to refer to, well, first of all, it got taken over in Confucianism to refer to the education system of passing the very difficult examinations. And so the fish who were able to go upstream were compared to the very few who passed successfully the final stage of the examination system. Then it got taken over in the symbolism of Zen to refer to the difficulty and the challenges of awakening. And again, there's, you know, if we look at the examples of Dogen, of Ruzheng, and Suxia, and the other Chinese poet that I mentioned, we look at those examples, there's a juxtaposition of the impetus to move and the equally important emphasis on staying put, staying in place, staying observant, realizing here and now at this place, at this moment. Okay, so I'll stop there and hope we can have some questions and discussion. Thank you.
Thank you, Stephen. So anyone who has comments, responses, questions for Stephen, you can raise your hand, or if you're not visible, you can go to the participants button on the bottom, and there's a way where you can, if you go to the bottom of that, just hit the raise hand button, and I'll call on people to discuss with Stephen. So any comments, questions, please feel free. So staying put and traveling around.
I see a hand. Ian?
Oh, Ian, yeah. Thank you.
I wanted to ask you about the foxhorn that Taiyin said you had written a book on it. And I wanted to know if you had any advice for integrating, I guess, the meat and potatoes of it into your life. The part where he says not falling into cause and effects, he's turning to a fox, and then not evading cause and effects releases Pejong from this body of a fox. And if you could, how am I supposed to practice with that?
The fox koan is a very fascinating topic, and you know, like a lot of the koans that Dogen discusses, these appear in other collections and commentaries on koans, and you can find it in the Gateless Gate. I think it's case number 2 there. And in the Book of Serenity, I think it's number 18 there, maybe. Gateless Gate is known for having kind of brief prose and poetic comments. And Book of Serenity has longer discussion. Now, Dogen discusses this. You know, what's one of the things that's very interesting about Dogen and his whole career is that he discusses this twice. There are two chapters specifically dedicated to this. One was written about, they were probably written about 10 years apart, one kind of middle of his career, one towards the end. And the typical Zen interpretation was that not ignoring causality and not falling into causality, which seemed like opposites, and the monk is punished for saying not falling into, and he does fall into causality by denying it, The typical interpretation is that these are two sides of the same coin. That's what the Gateless Gate poem says, two sides of the same coin. So that comes back to a perennial issue in Zen and maybe other forms of mysticism known as the antinomian issue. That is that when you're from the standpoint of non-duality, good and evil can kind of collapse into, you know, one unified vision. So what prevents you from breaking the rules and committing evil acts if ultimately you can justify it? And then from a bodhisattva standpoint, as skillful means, you may cut a cat in half or you may take actions that seem unethical. And what is the check and balance to prevent that from happening? And in Dogen's early interpretation of it, he seemed to support that view. He goes into detail about some detailed comments on some interesting aspects of the koan, because, for example, it says that the monk who denied causality and was turned into a fox lived for 500 lifetimes. I've looked at a lot of comments on this. Only Dogen says, well, is that 500 human lifetimes or 500 fox lifetimes? He gets off on a discussion of that. And then after the fox monk is released from his punishment by being a wild fox, a Buddhist funeral is given to the fox body. And Dogen goes into a long discussion that is it appropriate to sanctify with Buddhist ritual the body of a fox that represents delusion or not? So he has some very interesting comments, but he supports the kind of mainstream view. In the later interpretation, he switches and he says, no, you know, causality is the true teaching of Buddhism. And he has a whole chapter called Sanji Go, Karma in Three Times, This Life, Next Life, and Future Lives. And he's kind of very orthodox Buddhist there in saying, don't fall for the duality view. That's a kind of hoax. Now, how do we interpret that contradiction? This has been a big debate in Japanese interpretations for the last for several decades now, since a few of the commentators highlighted that discrepancy. So I'm not sure if I'm answering your question yet. I'm trying to give a little background there. But I think a passage I strongly recommend is in Shobogenzo Zui Monkey, Record of Things Heard, is one of the translations of that title. And he talks about this a little bit, but he also talks about the cat koan, where the cat is cut in half. And, is that an ethical action or not? I strongly recommend reading those few pages. And that's the kind of thing you can read over and over again. And what is Dogen's standpoint? But I think that Dogen... Dogen, like a Zen thinker, is not an ethicist. He's teaching is for the practice purposes. So the bottom line for me would be this. Dogen is saying have dignified behavior in all activities. Dignified behavior means you're sitting upright physically and mentally in everything that you do, whether that's sweeping the floor or washing yourself or brushing your teeth or, reciting rituals. And, of course, during Zazen, during walking meditation, and all other circumstances. And if you do that, the ethical problem kind of takes care of itself, so to speak. But people will bring up the question today, well, what would Dogen say about Black Lives Matter, for example? Would he be actively pro-civil rights, human rights, actively against the forces of suppression? That's harder to determine. Okay, so it's a great conversation, but I'll stop there on that comment.
Marcia's got her hand up.
Okay.
Thank you. Good evening, Stephen. Thank you for this talk.
Thank you.
And it's great to hear you. I'd like to ask you something about Marco Polo and Dogen. So I'm thinking you mentioned that they both were in China in the same century. They both went there, I'm assuming, to pursuing something, collecting something.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they also were both interested in sharing that. And I'd just like to hear your thoughts about how you'd compare them and how you'd compare the teaching they've handed down to us.
Yeah. Well, you know, I wrote the book called Did Dogen Go to China? Because there was a famous book, Did Marco Polo Go to China? And my publisher said, you know, that was not plagiarism. And so, it is so interesting. You know, when Dogen left China, the year he left China was the year Genghis Khan died in 1227. And Genghis Khan had solidified his power in the northern areas. Of course, that includes Beijing, which was not really part of China until the Mongols consolidated all of China. You know, his threat was being felt in the south, you know, in the areas Dogen was going to probably, but nobody knew exactly what was going to happen. But one interesting thing is that the Book of Serenity was written by a monk of the Soto school who lived in Beijing at the time in 1224. Now, Dogen would not have known about this because, there wasn't internet communication back then. But the point I want to make is that the guy who wrote the Book of Serenity in 1224 was closely connected with Genghis Khan. And he was asked to write a book about Zen that would incorporate some Confucian and Taoist teachings as well, but that would present to the Khans and say, okay, Zen is going to be, you know, the religion of the Khans. You know, we know that they were very authoritarian about some things, but very tolerant and open-ended. And Kublai Khan, you know, who hosted Marco Polo, was also very interested in Zen. And his teacher was the disciple of the guy who wrote the Book of Serenity 50 years later. So it's a very interesting connections there. But the parallels of Marco Polo and Dogen are that they are outsiders who, according to the stories they tell us, made it big time, you know, in the inner chambers of the institution. So Dogen, as a foreign monk, and foreign monks weren't usually treated that well, and if they were, it was the Koreans because they had a longer history in China. And Dogen all of a sudden becomes intimate with Ru Jing, who offers him the assistant, you know, to be his main assistant, and they're, you know, by implication, his successor eventually, because he dies soon anyway. And Dogen turns it down, he says. Now, did that really happen? I mean, I think it did happen. If Dogen said it, I'm not really denying it. But it's interesting narrative because, you know, Kublai Khan gets very close with Marco Polo. How does this happen? The Khans they had a kind of open-mindedness about things, but could that really have happened? That's the story. Now, you know, what's left out? Well, of the narratives, you know, Marco Polo doesn't tell us anything about the Great Wall. How could he have been in China and not talk about the Great Wall? And he doesn't talk about women having foot binding, even though he describes all these other customs. Dogen also, you know, if you look at what he describes, you could say it's limited by his own experience at a few temples here and there. But, he leaves out certain features of the Buddhist institution that, you know, it makes you wonder, well, why didn't he include those kind of details as well? So I think I think the message for understanding Dogen is that Dogen is not an autobiographer at all. And the biographies of Dogen come later and they have a lot of legends and they're kind of suspect from an historiographical standpoint. But Dogen was great at creating a narrative about himself. You know, I was born in the aristocracy, but I was an orphan. I became a monk very early on, but I had my doubts. I practiced Zen as soon as I could, but I never really succeeded in Japan. So I go to China and I'm disillusioned, but then I cast off body mind and I become, you know, I inherit the great transmission and only I understand it. And, you know, he's a very, very powerful storyteller, I think, when we read between the lines. And that's also what Marco Polo has, you know. So these stories now are lasting 800 years, and only getting more and more attractive, not less. But one other simple angle is this, that the Chinese, even though they were great record keepers, they didn't write stories about what it was like to be a monk in China. And Dogen does give us that. And same for Marco Polo. You know, you don't get the, those are still like the only sources. Marco Polo is still the only source to get a lot of information about. Now, I had a Chinese graduate student recently, and who a few years ago told me only recently in scholarship in China are they trying to compare what Marco Polo said with other, you know, historical records from that period. Sometimes it confirms and sometimes it contradicts him. Okay.
Thank you so much. That's really, really interesting.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Stephen.
Yes.
Other comments or questions, anyone?
Yeah, Sento.
I've been reading the pruning the Bodhi tree and the Dogen go to China, and then I kind of tried to look around, you know, because some of that is 20 years old, 30 years old even. Yeah. And I was wondering how that controversy is playing out now, the Hangaku thing and our Hakka Maya and the other writing.
Right. Yeah, I'm glad you asked that question. And that, you know, and the fox koan is related to that, because the interpretation towards the end of his life where he says causality, causality, causality is what the Professor Hakamai and Matsumoto in what's called critical Buddhism were emphasizing that point. And they said that, look, Dogen was getting very close to a social ethics here, and we should follow that implication and not the non-duality implication. So what happened is that movement, which was triggered off in the 1980s because the outcast community, there was kind of an uproar about the outcast community and discrimination committed by all the Buddhist sects and Japan, Japanese society in general. And there was a group that was convened in the Soto sect in the 1980s to kind of come to the idea, what would, you know, where does the sect stand in relation to these discrimination issues, and what would Dogen do, so to speak, if we, you know, he was back here today. That created quite an uproar for many years, maybe 10, 15 years in Japan, because they were pressing the point that we have to bring Dogen down to earth and look at him in terms of these issues, discrimination, gender issue, gender inequality, of course, nationalism in Japan, pre-war imperialism, the whole Zen at War issue. And so they were pressing all of those points. What to say? Well, Hakamaya was kind of a temperamental guy, and he got a lot of criticism. He was like the most forceful, and he got a lot of criticism, and he kind of withdrew from the debates. And he retired kind of early, and he renounced his Soto priesthood, and, you know, he just kind of went back, and he disappeared. That was probably in the early 2000s or so. And his colleague, Matsumoto, was a much more collegial type of person, so he kept the dialogue going. But he himself kind of got discouraged and pretty much gave up on it. I would see Matsumoto. He's exactly my age, and he just retired. And I don't know. And I was going to see him this summer, but we'll see. But anyway, he found that a few years ago, somebody in Korea was translating pruning the Bodhi tree, and they invited him to give a lecture there. So he was very excited. However, it turned out it was like a Christian group trying to make this anti-Buddhist statement, and so it kind of backfired on him. But In telling some of, you know, me and some other friends of his, there was somebody in Germany and, you know, a couple people scattered around who were still kind of holding the flame alive. You know, we had some more dialogues and discussions of it. And he still pressed the point. I know he was invited to Europe and Germany and Poland to give lectures on it. And so people are still interested. But now that he's retired, and I'm not sure if it's going to fade away or not, but to me, it's still, it still feels like it should be a current debate. I mean, I think you know, I think, Taigen, you talked about some of these issues in a recent Dharma talk, didn't you?
Well, I talked about the fox koan. For people who don't know about this, it's a complicated scholastic question. And, you know, going back to the fox koan, the question is, to what extent do we look at causality and look at the way in which the precepts can apply to current social ethic issues. And I think that's a very live topic for us in American Buddhism.
In American Buddhism, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's
part of the point, yeah.
Yeah, there's a Zen group online, a Facebook group, and, you know, in the wake of Black Lives Matter, some of us were asking, well, what is your practice? What is your practice with all this? And I got a lot of, you know, of this, I guess you might call it the Hangaku kind of, you know, approach of like, well, it doesn't really matter. Just worry about your own enlightenment, mm-hmm. kind of thing. And this, yeah, I think it's super relevant. And I mean, yeah, I think that they take it too far in what I'm reading in Pruning, you know, kind of throw the baby out with the bathwater sort of thing. But but at the same time, it's so important. Yeah.
But it does. Yeah, I totally agree with you. By the way, I mentioned this to Taigen, and I don't know if some of you are familiar with this book, Sky Flowers on the Day Before by Kazumitsu Kato. Anybody familiar with that? I just heard about it recently. He was an early member of the San Francisco Zen Center and knew Suzuki Roshi. I think preceded him as an interim director head of it for a couple of years. And I think went back to Japan and became a professor there. But anyway, the point I want to get to is that in this book, he describes kind of living with Dogen in all these practical situations. So he grew up and lived during the during World War II and the aftermath of World War II, and you know all the complications that caused. And there was an interesting passage where he says to a Zen teacher, his family was a member of a very prominent Soto temple in the city of Nagoya that had been very crucial to the modern publications of Shobogenzo and many other developments. So he had this big legacy that he was trying to continue to transmit. But after the war, you know, issues came up about kind of, you know, Japanese guilt for Buddhist guilt for kind of capitulating to the imperialism and, you know, a host of issues in that regard. The main point was that he said to one of the teachers, he made some reference to one of the teachers about some challenge, and the teacher just looked right past him and said, "What are you talking about?" And he said, and you know, because Kato was bringing up was something related to the war that was already 2 or 3 years ago. And then Kato's comment was, "Well, this was the typical Buddhist reaction that the Bodhisattva lives only in the present. So if it happened 2 or 3 years ago, it's like it didn't exist anymore." And I think, you know, what critical Buddhism was trying to bring up is that Buddhism should not fall into the, the kind of thinking of you get what you deserve and, you know, it is what it is and we can't change it and que sera, sera, kind of the negative aspect of that, the hongaku side of that, where you're just affirming the status quo. And everything is Genjo Koan in a way, you know, and that has to be shaken up. And I think that's where the legacy lives on. But I don't think even though this it got instigated within the heart of the Soto community, you know, they're not bringing it up in that regard. On the other hand, to look at it from a kind of positive standpoint, I think one of the things that happened in Soto and other forms of Buddhism in Japan was with the Fukushima, you know, earthquake and nuclear disaster, that the Buddhist temples in that region realized that they had to respond one way or the other. You know, they couldn't just say like, "Well, when's my temple going to get rebuilt?" Or, you know, talk about superficial things. And by a coincidence, a colleague of mine at my university, he works on Japanese sociology, and his theme is homelessness in Tokyo and Osaka. And, you know, one of the things that he's noticed is that since the earthquake, Buddhist groups, and not just in Tokyo, but people have come from other places, have really got involved in that social commitment issue to homelessness and broader, you know, issues of inequality. And, you know, when I first talked to him, he's been my colleague for like 15 years. And up until, you know, the first 5 years, if I brought up Buddhism, he had no interest in it other than it was a smug ancient tradition that wasn't doing much. And if homeless people lived nearby a big temple, they would put up a barrier so you didn't see them and that kind of thing. But his whole attitude has shifted quite a bit. And it's not just him. He said that there's a whole movement in that regard. So in that sense, I think it's partly the legacy of not just critical Buddhism, but the larger engaged Buddhism and you know, issues that have been brought up by a number of people and throughout Asia does live on.
Just if I may add that to that, in terms of American Soto Zen, I think, and so for Zento, if you look at the Ancient Dragon website, you'll see a few of my recent talks about this and talking about systemic racism and anti-racism. And so in terms of the Dogen issue about non-duality as opposed to precepts in terms of the Fox Koan, I'm not the only one, but I think Soto Zen in America is very much leaning towards precepts and responding to and speaking about social ethics. So just to say that, so American Soto Zen is very much about talking about social engagement and not universally, but pretty predominantly now. And so, but yeah, I think this is a question because it's important not to lose the sense of the awareness of the side of the upright and the universal and so forth. But especially now with the pandemic and the resistance to the history of racism in our country, to be present with responding to everything going on around us. So it's getting a little late, but maybe we can have one or two more questions or responses. I'm not sure. Yes.
Juan Pablo asked in the chat.
Yes, please.
You would like to ask, what does Stephen think about some of the implications of Dogen's thought in environmentalism, how Dogen can help to think, maybe think through the current ecological crisis?
Huge question, and good. Thank you. Stephen.
Yes. And I think when you look at the Shobo Genzo, there are some key chapters. Keisei Sanshoku, that's the one that quotes the Chinese poem, colors of the sounds of the valley streams, colors of the mountains, and San Sui Kyo, Mountains and River Sutras, and you know many many other examples. But those are probably the two main chapters that address nature and the environment and with implications that Gary Snyder and you know many others have been interested in and try to follow through with. There's a chapter on plum blossoms, which is the a symbol in Chinese and Japanese culture for renewal because it's the first flower that blooms when the snow is still on the ground kind of indicates the impetus towards springtime coming. And Dogen says, you know, the plum blossom doesn't come because it's spring. When the plum blossom comes, it's spring. And that's his emphasis on the kind of, you know, view of being time. And I think in a lot of the poems that Dogen wrote, both in Chinese and Japanese, that's one of the interests I've had over the years is his poetry. And which Taigen has translated, and you know, so translations are out there, and I've done some. You know, he's often communing with nature. So a lot of times they would write the poems by leaving the temple ground. So it was a kind of tradition in China and Japan for the head of the temple to go off to a retreat outside of the main grounds and contemplate, kind of recharge their spiritual energy. And they usually wrote about nature. And, you know, what Dogen often says in those poems is he tries to tell himself, like, okay, nature is kind of a model and a mirror and a mentor, but don't just get enraptured with the beauty of nature, but then he'll see the blossoms or he'll see the autumn leaves, and all of a sudden he wants to pick up his pen and write a poem celebrating it. And but then he tries to tell himself, no, you know, first of all, I'm not a great poet. You know, and poetry is not the Zen path. So a lot of his, I think a lot of the emphasis in Dogen kind of is in that more micro level. The ecological challenges, and my understanding of this is kind of basic, so I'll take it with a grain of salt. But the ecological challenges that we face today, were less present. Having said that, you know, one time I gave a lecture in Ancient Dragon on the famous rhinoceros koan that is in a Book of Serenity and Blue Cliff Record. And, you know, that koan was probably created around the 700 or 800s. And even by then, they said that deforestation and urbanization was causing a decline in the rhinoceros population. And they noticed that rhinoceros, which were kind of very well known, were now some exotic animal you had to travel to go to see. So they did have an awareness of human implications. And I'm sure, you know, probably since the Sumerian civilization 5000 BC that they say died out because they destroyed, you know, as they got wealthier, they destroyed the environment to get resources to maintain their wealthy status. You know, that this has been part of human condition for a while. But when Dogen's meditating in the mountains in Ahaji and is saying that the cries of the monkey are the same as hearing the Lotus Sutra, you know, that to me, it seems like he's not having to be faced with those kinds of challenges. So what are the practical implications? Now, you know, we all know that, you know, there's a concept, olioki, to refer to the bowls, that you have just enough food. That one thing Dogen emphasizes, just enough. You know, nobody needs a grain of rice. Nobody's left out of a grain of rice, and you don't cook one extra grain of rice. And I mean, I think that's an implication I don't know what the term is. The contemporary term is, it's a kind of minimalism, or it's a moderation, or, you know, it's something that that, you know, we can enact on in our everyday lives, and that and it, as he says, like one good deed or one moment of zazen spreads out and affects all people at all times. So, I think it's great. You guys are asking the kind of mega questions, environment, racism. I think about those a lot too. I think gender is another, major issue, because Dogen talks about the women are equal, but then, you know, how does he act out? How does he act this out at his temple? These are very big issues that demand more attention. And but I'm not sure if I'm the one who has the answers.
So it's we're running late, and anybody who
has a question.
Excuse me? Yeah, anybody who needs to leave, please. Douglas, did you have but we have the opportunity of having Stephen with us now, so anybody who wants to stay is welcome to. Douglas, did you have a question?
Well, I had a sort of more mundane question.
Go ahead.
And either Stephen, you or Taigen may be able to answer. Some years ago now, Shuhaku Okumura was at Ancient Dragon and spoke about the Canon Fascicul of Shobogenzo. And Shohaku mentioned a poem that that Dogen had written after, with respect to making a pilgrimage to a famous site where people would have visions of Canon. And apparently the poem said something along the lines, well, there was no need for me to come here because I can see Canon everywhere. Does that ring a bell with you?
Yes, it does. Okay, so if you go to where Dogen went, China, and you know, there was a port city. I mean, this goes back to the Marco Polo question, because the port city that Dogen and Japanese visitors went to before and during and after Dogen's time is a town called Ningbo. Had a different name in that era, but it's a town named Ningbo, and it's near the city of Hangzhou, which was the capital city for a while in the Southern Song Dynasty. And Marco Polo, you know, spent time in Hangzhou, and he described it in some detail. And he also, when he departed China to go back to Europe, he left at the port of Ningbo, and that's where Dogen was. Now, right outside of Ningbo, there's a small island called Putoshan. Puto is Chinese meaning Buddha, is a pronunciation for Buddha. So it's Buddha Island, but it's dedicated to Canna. And it's a beautiful island where the temples are very well maintained, and they never apparently never suffered in the Cultural Revolution. And you know, so it's a great kind of touristy area, but it's a very spiritual area. It's all temples, and some of the islands nearby are also very dominated by Buddhist temples. And but you know, in Dogen's era, one of the things was that in Dogen's era, the word Putoshan was used for other islands where there were a lot of temples. Some were, you know, off the coast of Japan. Some were, you know, closer to China. So it's hard to, you know, there's a little bit of ambiguity about whether his poem is describing that island or maybe one of the other islands. But I got to believe it was that famous island, because it was famous back then as well. And, you know, and he wrote two poems. One was on his way to China, apparently, and the other was on his way from China. And actually, I was just writing something in something I'm working on now, where I was comparing the two poems. And, you know, it occurred to me, and they're in Dogen's extensive record. So you can find them in the book that that Taigen and Shohaku translated, that I'm using to prop up my laptop to bring it to, like, you know, my...
The big book.
Yes, but I always tell Taigen, you know, I have the book next to me. I have a PDF file of it. I have it on Kindle, so I can search it more easily, and I have the hard copy next to me to constantly refer to. And so you can see the true translations there. And I was trying to think, those two poems, was there a difference? Like, was the second poem, when he's leaving, more, can you see casting off body mind, you know, affecting his writing? And I think you can. I can't quite remember the wording details off the top of my head now, but you can check in the book. So I think I answered your question then, right?
Yeah, thank you. I'll go take a look at the two poems. Yeah. And see.
And of course, there's also the legend that when Dogen was leaving China, you know, he had several challenges. One was that a tiger came to attack him, and he was able to climb up to the branches of a tree, and through the power of meditation, he dispelled the tiger. And another was that he got sick to his stomach, and then a deity came from Japan and brought him medicine, and that cured him. And then the formula for that medicine, throughout medieval and early modern Japan, was something that was sold at Soto Zen temples as a panacea. And the third challenge was that there was a typhoon, and then Canon appeared floating on a single leaf, known as the single leaf Canon, and saved him during that storm, and he might not have made it back otherwise.
And so, there's a picture of that event at Ancient Dragon's Zen Gate on Irving Park Road in the back wall that Dogen inscribed on the deck of the boat. That's the picture on the back wall behind where the Tenzo sits, and Dogen inscribed it, and you can see Kanon sitting on a leaf on the ocean.
You got that in Kyushu, right?
Yeah, and when he landed in Kyushu, the guy at the temple where he landed copied it and brought it to him in Kyoto, and he inscribed it. So we have that at Ancient Dragon.
Yeah, so it's one of the interesting things, because obviously it sounds legendary and mythological, but then here's the image that you have that kind of confirms that that there's some truth to that, or something must have happened in his experience to give rise to it. Unless, you know, some skeptics would say, well, maybe some of these things were manufactured later. But some skeptical
scholars would say something like that. Yes.
Touche.
Any last questions for Stephen while we have him? Any basic questions? Any questions about Dogen or Zen? Yes, Ed, go ahead.
Thank you, Stephen, very much. Just in general, you know, the human experience of recognition, or how is that related in a way, in the act of staying, going, departing, or returning from, you know, physical places or, say, from ideas themselves? Is recognition as something that it invites responsibilities, of course. It can choose, it can inspire those. But it isn't recognition, the experience of recognition require all those behaviors all happening at the same time?
Yeah, that's a very...
Such that they're not exclusive of one another as actions, by any means.
The they meaning the travel and the return? Yeah. Yes. Yeah, that's a very interesting point. You know, a friend of mine who I was kind of running some of these ideas by pointed out that in Japanese, when you leave the home and you tell, you know, your spouse or somebody in the family you're leaving the home, the word you use implies I'm going and I'm coming back. It implies the return. That kind of highlights it. Now, when you bring up the word recognition, I always think back to the early Buddhist doctrine known as the five aggregates, that human beings are made up of five aggregates, and the leading up to the development of consciousness or awareness. And the recognition is the third aggregate. And, you know, if we look at the word in English, it means to cognize again. So recognition, you know, in one interpretation, in one Buddhist interpretation, recognition implies that we already know something. We've already had a sensation or some kind of glimmer. And then we cognize it. And that means we label it, we categorize it, we identify it. You know, and that's what it is. And of course, in doing that, we understand a little bit better, but we also tend to make it kind of stagnant, or we kind of reify a concept and cut it off from the dynamic flow of the reality. So I think, you know, Dogen doesn't talk about the five aggregates in detail, and he, you know, but he, you know, something he obviously, knew well, and I try to relate that in my mind to some of the things that Dogen is saying. So when Dogen is saying Buddhists are becoming Buddhists, you know, that's a recognition of self-identity that we somehow always, you know, he does use the term a couple of times, we always already, you know, he has that distinction thinking, not thinking, and non-thinking or beyond thinking. But he says we're always already in the third step of non-thinking. It's just like we haven't, you know, to connect it with what you're saying, we haven't recognized that yet, generally. You know, and Zazen, you know, causes the awareness that we can become conscious of that state. But it's always happening anyway. So I think the, so if I'm understanding the implication of what you're saying is that the, you know, if we get back into that pivot from the glimmer to the recognize it, that is the pivot where we understand that non-thinking is the basis of thinking, and not the basis of it, because that makes it seem like it's a third thing cut off from thinking and not thinking, or there's some kind of dialectical progression. But it is, you know, thinking itself is non-thinking or beyond thinking. Not thinking itself is always already non-thinking. So the movement here and there and back and forth and up and down, you know, like in the extensive record you know, in a couple of sermons and what I call sermons, Dharma discourses. And Taigen describes in the introduction, you know, the performative quality, what he does, what Dogen does with the staff and the fly whisk. And one time he takes the staff and he says, I hold it, you know, I hold it vertically, you know, and it reaches to the sky, and I hold it horizontally and it covers the entire earth. And that's the point where up and down, before and after, and you know, that's that, all those dualities become blended into the one. But if we go back to the antinomian issue or the ethical issue, to, in response to those other questions, you know, that is also the point where we have to kind of dance away from turning that into another reification and dance back into immersing ourselves in the particularities of the polarity.
Or as a modern poet said, get back to where you once belonged.
Yes, that's right. Lennon McCartney.
Yeah. So we're way over time, and you're even later. So we're it's way past your bedtime, Stephen.
Yes, it's past.
Are you willing to take one last question?
Sure.
Anybody else have something to say, or some question, or some comment, or some utterance before we all go to bed? Ah, Bo.
Yeah, one more. I mean, thank you again for your talk tonight. I really appreciate it. I'm just kind of curious about, like, having not been to Japan, like, what's the status of Dogen in Japan sort of generally, even, you know, outside of the academy, outside of the university, even outside of, like, temple? Like, is he popular? Do people on the street know Dogen? What's their relationship to him? Like, I'm kind of curious about, like, his kind of place in Japanese culture overall, you know.
Right. Yeah, good. Well, you know, I mean, there's one thing that you find in Japan is the whole issue of Buddhism and religion in general and Japanese. It's kind of so deeply ingrained that when we ask kind of Western style questions in surveys for Japanese, like, do you believe in religion? Do you follow religion? They kind of say no, you know, and then you go to their neighborhood and you see they have a festival every weekend, and there's a, you know, shrine which everybody's visiting, and you know, and all these activities are going on, but people don't kind of recognize them in that way. And Dogen's a little bit similar. So what I found is, and you know, this I've had some interactions with students at universities, and they act like they never heard of Dogen, you know. And a lot of times they'll go like, oh, it's something in Buddhism, right? Or whatever. Now, if you talk to them more and you know, you go like, hey, no, this isn't like some superficial interview or something. I'm trying to, you know, then they do know a lot about it. Or maybe they don't know it's Dogen, but a lot of the ideas, they are familiar with them. And then you have to kind of tie it into Dogen. Now, one of the things in terms of the, a little bit broader view of it is that Dogen's, you know, in 2003 was the 750th death anniversary of Dogen. The 50-year anniversaries of death are the big markers for the Buddhist patriarchs in the different schools and for other cultural figures. So that was a big anniversary. They had a kabuki play about Dogen. There was a movie that's been shown with subtitles in America quite a bit, simply called Zen, a kind of biopic. There were a lot of manga and TV shows, and you know, it was it's quite present. You know, Eheiji is something people have on their bucket list to visit. But when you coalesce about the idea of this is Dogen, that becomes a little bit more ambiguous. So in a way it is a little disappointing sometimes, but in a way it's very rewarding, because when you get past that superficial level.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. There is something, let me actually, hold on one second here.
Please.
This is kind of brings the whole discussion full circle. These two books, you can see these are kind of manga type books.
Hold it up to the camera higher. Yeah. Okay.
And if you see, there's text and there's a lot of illustrations. Mm-hmm. And this is Dogen. This is a whole manga on Dogen. And this is one of the books that I consult the most because it was written by a Soto priest named Nakano Tozen. He also did this one. This one's on Zen. So it's got a section on Dogen, but it also has, you know, Rinzai Zen and other aspects. So these two, they go into quite a lot of detail. This guy, Nakano Tozen, is an interesting guy because he, when we talked about critical Buddhism and the original issue that came up in the 1980s, Nakano Tozen was on that committee that was formed with a couple of professors. So they had like three or four university professors and a couple of Soto priests. And he never really bought into the whole criticism, skepticism, because he was more of a defender of the institution, which is understandable. But all these years later, so this guy must be older than me and Taigen put together. all these years later, he's pumping out these books. And he wrote a book a couple of years ago called Nichiyobi Shobogenzo. Nichiyobi is Sunday. So it's Shobogenzo for Sunday. And Professor Matsumoto, who was one of the original critical Buddhism people, he, when I mentioned it to him, he sneered and he goes like, oh, that's just defending the status quo and that's the whole problem. You know? But at the same time, that book is very interesting because it says like, you know, it takes several basic Dogen sayings like enlightenment, you know, there's enlightenment is embedded in delusion. Delusion is not the opposite of enlightenment. The ultimate question is how do we, you know, face life and death? And it takes these basic Dogen sayings and it applies them to people's everyday life, you know, which is, I think, some questions that are coming up today, you know, how do you do that? And so in that sense, I'm not sure who's motivated to buy that book. I don't know if it's like kind of, you know, people whose families are traditionally members of the Soto sect turn to it, or people in a bookstore or, you know, Amazon JP will turn to it and say like, okay, you know, this is going to be inspiration. I'm not, you know, I haven't quite looked at that aspect of it, but the bottom line is that, you know, Dogen has such a, you know, boom of interest in US that's growing and growing, and Taigen and Tanahashi and Okamura, you know, and other people are contributing. And Dogen is alive and well in Japan. I guess that's the bottom line.
Yeah. That's great.
Yeah.
So, we have to stop at some point. So let's just do it now.
Okay.